Hello and welcome to Home to Her, the podcast that's dedicated to reclaiming the lost and stolen wisdom of the sacred feminine. I'm your host, Liz Kelly, and on each episode, we explore her stories and myths, her spiritual principles, and most importantly, what this wisdom has to offer us right now. Thanks for being here. Let's get started. Hey, everybody, before we dive into this next episode, I wanted to pop on here and give a little plug for my next upcoming course through the Home to Her Academy. It's called Returning to the Well, Sacred Wisdom for the Motherhood Journey. And I'm teaching this in partnership with the wonderful and amazing Elizabeth Gould, who is a past podcast guest, and also a mother, writer, teacher, and menstrual activist, and the former director of a nonprofit dedicated to positive menstrual and menopausal education and awareness. We have been collaborating and dreaming this up for many months now. And this is a 5-week online course that explores the divine journey of motherhood and what it means to parent in partnership with the sacred feminine. It begins Sunday, October 29th. Classes are at 2 p.m. Eastern time. They're live and will be recorded if you are not able to join in person. And as always, all the classes through Home to Her Academy are designed to be interactive and engaging. So for this one, we will include the historical perspectives on motherhood, goddesses and archetypes that teach us about divine mothering, discussion around what it means to weave the sacred into our everyday parenting practices and activities, creative writing exercises, movement, meditation, and more. And we are offering this at this time of year for a very specific reason. If you're listening to this when it's released, you know that we're headed into the end of the year, which can get very, very hectic with the holidays for a lot of us. So we want to explore together what it means to bring more intention, more care, and more self-care to these times, which will benefit not only our children, but ourselves. So check it out. Classes are offered live on Zoom. Starts October 29th on a Sunday. You can learn more and register at hometoheracademy.com, and you can find all of this in the show notes. And that's it. Hope you enjoy today's show. Hey, everybody, and welcome to the show. This is Liz joining you as usual from Central Virginia and the unceded lands of the Monacan Nation. And I am so glad that you are here with me today. And if you listen to the show, you know what's coming next. If you want to find out whose native lands you are on, go to native-land.ca. There's a fantastic map of the entire world. Super helpful, particularly for the Americas, I think. I don't know a whole lot beyond there, but you can find out whose native lands you might be residing on. And I put that in the show notes always. And if you are interested in learning about the sacred feminine in a deeper way, as opposed to just listening to these shows, you may want to check out my online school, Home to Her Academy. My vision for this school is to bring together qualified, really engaging instructors who can teach us about the sacred feminine in ways that are first rooted in the historical record. If you've been listening for a while, you know I'm kind of into this. So, and it's there. We might as well know it. It's our birthright. But also in ways that are embodied and intuitive. So invite us to know with more than our minds. In ways that are intersectional. So really talking about these messy entanglements of spirituality, patriarchy, misogyny, racism, colonialism, all the isms. And then finally, in ways that are practical. So meaning that we can apply this to our normal, ordinary, complicated lives. So if that sounds interesting to you, check out hometoheracademy.com to see what's going on. You can sign up for my newsletter while you're there. So if you don't see anything happening right now, it doesn't mean they're not coming up. I'm working on getting everything ready for the 2024. 2024 year. So keep checking back if you don't see a whole lot there. That doesn't mean I'm not working really hard behind the scenes on getting this all ready. And then if you'd rather read about the sacred feminine, maybe check out my book, Home to Her, Walking the Transformative Path of the Sacred Feminine from Womancraft Publishing. It is a 2023 Nautilus Gold Award recipient. Wahoo. I'm going to stop saying that at the end of this year, but I'm just going to keep bragging about it all year because it's a 2023 thing. It's available wherever you buy your books, but please do consider buying it from Womancraft. They are an amazing woman-owned business, or order it from your local bookstore. And reviews on Amazon and Goodreads are super helpful. If you have read it and you liked it, I'd love if you would take a moment and leave a review. And the same goes for this podcast. They're super helpful on iTunes, Apple Podcasts in particular, but I will take them anywhere you want to leave them. And Finally, if you like the show or you've got feedback on episodes, please do tell me what you think. I'll put it all in the show notes, but you can reach out on social is usually the best way to get a hold of me or send me an email. And I'll put all that in the show notes. All right. So with that, let's get on with it. So if you're listening to this on or near the release date in the Northern Hemisphere, then you know that seasonally speaking, we are entering into the season of death. And where I live in Virginia, the leaves are starting to drop from their trees, the nights are getting longer, the days are getting a little bit colder, and death and endings are upon us and all around us. And of course, in reality, death is always a part of life. But I think this particular moment in time offers an opportunity to turn our attention to it and the inevitability of it in a meaningful, and if we can do so, a curious way too. What does death have to teach us? Anybody who spends any time with a historical record of the sacred feminine, I think is going to find out pretty quickly that birth and life and death are all pretty intertwined in many goddess traditions, which offers us a different way to approach the subject right off the bat. And I have really been looking forward to exploring this particular topic with my guest today. I'm sure we're going to talk about some other stuff too. But I know that she brings a lot of wisdom and expertise in this subject, and I'm excited to hear from her. So let me introduce her to you now. Reverend Angie Buchanan is a founder and the spiritual director of Earth Traditions, a pagan church, and of Gaia's Womb, an interfaith spirituality group that has been producing spiritual retreats for women since 1998. She is a lifelong pagan and animist and has been an experienced magical worker and ritualist for over 40 years. She served on the Board of Trustees for the Parliament of World Religions from 2002 to 2010, being the first pagan to be elected, offering programs internationally at convenings in Barcelona, Melbourne, and Toronto, and nationally in Salt Lake City and Chicago. I was there. Somehow we didn't manage to connect. Most recently in Chicago. We were both there.
It was a big place.
It was a big place. There were 7,500 people there. Yeah, it was. And at some point, I really would like to do an episode that talks about that experience. We'll see if I can make that happen. But back to Angie. She was inducted into the Martin Luther King Jr. College of Ministers and Laity at Morehouse College in 2015. Reverend Buchanan is currently a spiritual advisor for pagan students at the University of Chicago campus ministry and a certified death midwife, having developed a program that provides hands-on intensive training for compassionate end-of-life care and information about ecologically sensitive funerals. And she is joining us today from her home in Southeast Wisconsin. Angie, thank you so much for being here. It's an honor to have you.
Thank you, Liz. I am thrilled to be here. I'm excited to have the conversation, and I appreciate the invitation to talk about the things that are really important to me and in my world. So I thank you.
Yeah, wonderful. Let's get into it. Let's talk about death. But no, before we go there, I'd love to hear a little bit about your spiritual background, you know, what your experience was growing up. And I always tell guests that, you know, I always ask this just because I'm curious. First of all, I like to hear these things, but also I'm curious if there's anything that was worth keeping, like if you were grounded in something that you have been able to carry through in your life, or if there's something that you needed to turn away from. So yeah, let's start there if that works for you.
Sure. So I'm kind of, I've lived all over the place. I come from sort of a nomadic line of people. We arrived in the United States in 1923. And my mother gave birth to three children. And then when I was 3 years old, she stepped into a situation where there was a widower who had seven children. And so our families merged, and I grew up as the youngest in a family of 10. My mother was pagan. She called herself that, but I don't think it meant the same thing as contemporary paganism has steered it toward. So about a year after she married this man, and it's a long, irrelevant story, but he left, and she continued to raise the 10 of us together. So I really never knew life without them. And we were kind of a a clan. We constantly had family, and I use that term loosely, coming and going. There were campground, camping and fires and social gatherings in our backyard the whole time I was growing up. I was probably in my late teens before I really understood that I didn't have 200 aunts and uncles. And so I was raised in sort of an environment that encouraged the idea of this overall pervasive force as female. And it was Mother Earth. It was the idea that the matriarchal societies that had been left behind had left our world a worse place. And we lived our lives by the cycles of the season. We were animists. As I was growing up, I was instructed that if anybody asked me what my religion was, and back during that time, it was considered pretty rude to ask someone that. But if I were asked, I was to tell them that I was pagan and to immediately follow it up by saying that I was also communist. And this sort of made usually the adults that were asking be a bit put off, because our family was a little bit of an enigma. My mom was a scandal because she was divorced and, you know, had all these children, and we didn't really show up at the local churches. And so there was some curiosity you know, just coming from that kind of background really shaped me. One of the things that it did was it piqued my interest in religions and other religions, because I really couldn't understand the concept of monotheistic patriarchal rulerships and kingdoms. And these are the ways that I thought about it as a child growing up and as a young adult. And so I was very interested in exploring what attracted people to those religions. And there was a point in time where I kind of got away from the practices that that I had been raised with regard to being hardwired to know where the cycles were and to do something intentional during that time. This was a situation where I just wanted to disavow from all of it. It was too complicated to talk with other colleagues about because they had no context. I was raised in Princeton, New Jersey. I moved to Los Angeles, where I went to college, and then ended up taking a job in Kentucky and moved from there to Chicago and from Chicago to Wisconsin. So you can kind of see there's sort of both coasts in the middle happening there. But it just became easier for me to not talk about it. So I got very heavily involved in the political sphere. And if people would then ask me, you know, what's your religion? I would tell them I was a Democrat. So I chaired campaigns. I worked in campaigns. I did a lot of work within a fairly like state sized, which eventually led to federal sized sphere. And I realized as I was moving through that most of what I was doing was educating the candidates about the First Amendment and how there couldn't be a breach of church and state and how they couldn't use their religious structures and environments and belief systems to legislate by. And if I could have that conversation with a candidate that I was working with, then and they came around to understand what it was that I was trying to say, then I felt like I really could dig in and kind of had a reputation for not losing a race. So that really informed my move forward into what I was doing. So,
yeah. Well, and then can you kind of bring us here? So, you, as the spiritual director of Earth Traditions, right? I assume you made your way back from defining yourself as a Democrat spiritually into something different, right?
Yes. Yeah. So what I realized, again, even as I was in that political sphere, was that I was still kind of hardwired to do things with the cycle. It was something that would pop into my head. And it was something as simple as setting forth intention during the waxing periods and cutting away what was unnecessary during the waning periods. And even if it was just that simple, and it all starts with breath. We breathe in, we live, we exhale, we die, right? And as long as we keep doing that, we get to stay human. So we stop doing it, and whatever it is that animates us leaves us, and we cease to be in our human state. So that's the cycle that is hardwired in all of us. We've just not been given the language for it. And so as I started to move through, I became acquainted with contemporary paganism, and I became associated with a couple of different groups that were holding events and practicing, and I sort of learned about, this is the first time I'd learned about Wicca, and I watched that. This is like back in the mid-90s, early to mid-90s, watching Wicca. I ended up meeting Margot Adler, and those conversations were pretty informative, and she and I formed a friendship, a very close friendship over the years until she died in 2014. And I just learned a lot about how different faith traditions take their doctrine from paganism, essentially. And I use that word loosely because it happens all over the world, but the whole world is neither familiar nor does it embrace the word pagan. And so I think that it's important for us to understand that all faith traditions are essentially based on the agricultural cycle, and they manifest that cycle with different stories and different rituals of their own.
Mm-hmm. And Margot Adler, I know she wrote Drawing Down the Moon. Just for listeners who may not know who she is, can you say quickly who she was?
Yeah, absolutely. Margot Adler did write Drawing Down the Moon and Heretic's Heart. She was a Wiccan priestess. To start out, she was Gardnerian. But she was also an NPR correspondent. And so her voice was pretty well known across the radio waves with regard to her work with social justice and human rights. And she was very much invested in goddess spirituality.
Nice. Thank you. Yeah. And another word that I was wondering if you would help for listeners maybe who aren't familiar with the idea of animist, what could you say a little bit more about that too?
Sure. Animism is an acknowledgement that life force runs through everything here on the planet. And I love the idea that it's becoming a little bit more well-known in the general languaging, in that we're discovering lots of different things that would not have been acceptable even 30 years ago. So I don't know if folks are aware that India declared that dolphins are non-human people, and that you're not allowed to just slaughter them or catch them in nets. We're learning more about mycelium and the way it networks and communicates across the entire surface of the globe, and these creatures that the blooms are and what they can be used for, and The idea that things that we would have not considered sentient or intelligent are being discovered to have languages and to communicate with one another. And so that feeds directly into animism, because for me, that's the same energy that animates me. And as with everything, once that energy reaches the end of its lifespan, whatever it is that it was inhabiting, it leaves that vessel, and that vessel ceases to be what it was. So it's the idea that there is a life force that animates everything, even though we may not recognize it as being something that is the same, or that we accept as being like us. And because we humans tend to establish hierarchical command over and feel like everything other than human is lesser than. But I would remind you that we were brought to our knees by a teeny tiny little virus not so long ago. And, you know, that had a mind of its own and a will to live too.
Yeah, absolutely. And yes, and I also think of that hierarchy and dominance as being specific to a particular way of viewing the world, right? That you don't necessarily see in indigenous cultures that have survived colonization. And right. I was raised Southern Baptist. Everybody who listens to the show knows that, but you know, that seems also very intertwined with patriarchal religion, you know, and the idea of a dominant father God encoded right there in the Bible. I also wanted to say, because what you said about the dolphins, I did not know that. I will look for a reference to this and put it in the show notes if I can find it, because that's really interesting to me. But I may have this wrong, so I'll see if I can find this in the show notes for the show notes too. But this is also making me think of, there's a something called the Mountain Valley Pipeline here on the East Coast to carry oil through West Virginia and Virginia and North Carolina, and was kind of... there was a whole sort of legal finagling by the current administration to get it passed, to get opposition moved off the table so that it would move forward. And I believe was reading recently that one of the remaining legal options available is, I'm not sure if it's exactly looking at personhood for the rivers that are going to be affected by this, but to your point about animism, recognizing that those waters are alive and living and feed many, many other beings, not just humans. And if I haven't said that as clearly as I'd like, so I'm going to look and see if I can find any resources about that and put that in the show notes for anybody who's interested.
And I think also beings that basic humanity either refuses to take the time to think about, or believes they already have the answer in their patriarchal theology. But beings that we wouldn't be able to survive without.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think that, you know, one of the things that is important to me is to fully understand for myself and to engage with the fact that we live on a living, sentient being on this planet. And there are levels of other kinds of beings that have different functions to keep the planet alive. And without certain pieces of that, this planet will survive just fine. But whether or not it survives in a way that continues to be hospitable to human life is the question that we need to be looking at. And I think that there's a lot of frivolous word salad going on amongst our leadership to do that patriarchal fatherly, there, it's all going to be okay. And it's not going to be okay.
Yeah. Yeah. I find myself becoming increasingly angry and frustrated and wanting to climb on top of a mountain and shout that we cannot expect wounded, unhealed men to lead us to a better place here. Like we have got to give up that dream. It will not happen. It's not going to happen.
Right.
And I don't know what that means, you know, and what the alternative is yet, but I think letting go of that fantasy seems to be like a really important first step.
And I also think that we can't lay it all on the shoulders of the men. A lot of it we can, but we have women who are complicit.
Absolutely.
And maybe that's the place to start. But I think that women have been fighting so hard for so long to wrestle back some piece of autonomy and a place of wisdom and direction. And in doing so, they've almost had to be men, or that patriarchal mentality. And I think that there's masculine and there's feminine, and there are attributes that are decidedly within our society, masculine or feminine. And the way of the world right now is very, very masculine, but it's happening on a very feminine planet, which constantly manifests itself. It is always giving birth to itself. It is always dying and rebirthing. And it's speaking to us in a language that we've forgotten or never known. And I think that Indigenous cultures have so much to teach us. And it's not been very long since we were just dismissing them as ignorant. And yet I would remind you that in 2004, there was a tsunami in Thailand. And there were two different indigenous populations there. I think both of them were under 2,000 people each, but they, and I quote this, they heard the water speak. And so when the water spoke, they understood the language and they moved to the hills and they survived. And all of those people in their expensive beachfront resorts on their iPhones and computers perished because they've forgotten the language of the planet. It doesn't speak in English. It doesn't tap you on the shoulder. Those are metaphors. It has its own language. It communicates very clearly. And that kind of goes back to the basis of my spiritual life, which is that if there is anything that has authority over me in any way that mirrors God, Goddess, it's the elements. It's earth, it's air, it's fire, it's water, it's earthquakes, it's tsunamis and cyclones and forest fires. And, you know, it's the idea that when one of those things presents itself, you don't argue with it. You get out of the way. The voice, the language is very clear. The message is very clear. Get out of the way or I'll kill you. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's pretty authoritative. And I'm not seeing any answer to that other than to blame it on evil coming out of the monotheistic patriarchal religions. But, you know, this is definitely a being or a combination of beings that are articulating pretty clearly what it is that they want and they need. And we're not listening.
Yeah. Yeah. And I want to clarify too, to your point about, and it's a good point. It feels important to clarify too, that when I reference men, it's not so much, I'm thinking of the people that I see on TV and the leaders that we have elected, which, you know, often feel very paternalistic and I've got this figured out. And in fact, they don't.
Right. Right. There's a lot of false bravado and arrogance.
Yeah. Yeah.
The deadly combination.
Yes. well, I wonder if you could talk then too about, This idea of the sacred feminine, if you don't like that language, please feel free to use other language. I would imagine if you grew up in this matriarchal house, pagan household, that you had some concept of the sacred feminine from an early age. So I want to say lucky you, how that feels. That sounds like a beautiful thing. But I'd love to hear you talk about your understanding of her in however you would describe her, and if there was a particular moment when you understood that there was an aspect of the divine that is the divine feminine, or if that's just something you kind of always had because of your upbringing.
Well, I think that a couple of things. First of all, the idea of, again, the agricultural cycle. So the annual, the perennial god is the annual god kind of thing. Yeah. And I don't even know where to start with this, Liz, but I, having grown up feeling or being told that the moon was feminine, that the earth is feminine, and understanding that when I engaged with nature, one of the other things that I call myself, I'm an awe junkie. Mm. So there are certain things that happen in the world, and almost without exception, they are something to do with the natural world that just absolutely takes my breath, takes my words, makes me just want to sink down to my knees. And I'm just so awestruck by the beauty or the power or the multifaceted presentation that I'm viewing, that I just want to be part of it. I just want to sink in and be part of it. And for me, most often, that voice is feminine. It's softer. It's nurturing. It provides sustenance. It feeds, and it just feels very maternal to me. And then there are other times where it feels more sisterly. There were 8 females in our family unit, including my mom. And so I really had an upbringing that was surrounded and encompassed by women. And my brothers, there were 3 of them. They were also kind and protective. And so they also showed those facets of the non-toxic male. And I just feel like this has infused my whole life, because it wasn't necessarily a religion per se. It was a way of life. And growing up believing the voice of a woman is divine, and that we are all sacred, and we all have the sacred divine feminine within us, no matter how our body expresses itself. And there's that marriage, the sacred marriage, the eros gamos, that happens, the merging of male and female within ourselves. And again, language has changed, so I don't mean to be either instructing or using verbiage that anybody else would not feel welcomed by. But I am saying that there are many facets that have typically been attributed to masculine or feminine, and that we merge those within ourselves, and we all can aspect the divine feminine.
Yeah. And I know one of the things that you said to me before we hopped on here too, is that your kind of experience of the sacred feminine is less about deity and more about archetype. And so I wonder if you could speak to that a little bit too.
Yeah. So archetype, for me, to really simplify it, archetype is like a job description. So, so if we take all of the pantheons and we put them, you know, each in a row, stacked on top of each other or side by side, we discover that within every pantheon, there are goddesses of war and goddesses of birth and goddesses of destruction and goddesses of nurturing and goddesses of love and similarly gods. But in each pantheon, there are those slots and there's somebody that fits into them. So the idea that we need a language, we need a common language to be able to describe this kind of thing, the energetic imprint of a warrior goddess is going to be much different than the energetic imprint of a birthing goddess. And just to become aware of how those energies are expressed through us, as well as preserved in mythology across the world, can explain, I believe, can explain a lot of things that people really grapple with.
Yeah, and the idea is not so much that we are, like it's all divinity, right? Like it's all aspects of the divine. So then, it's not like you as an individual would necessarily embody one aspect, right? Just like the divine doesn't embody one aspect. Like we can find ourselves archetypally throughout all of them in some ways, right? Would you agree?
Yeah,
with that?
Yeah, and it changes.
Yeah.
You know, we can, they're multifaceted. So we are also multifaceted and we can express that energetic piece depending on the situation that we're in. And you know, it's like shape shifting. You shape shift, we shape shift every day. You know, we wear a mask in different contexts every day. We're not the same person exactly when we walk into our doctor's office as we are when we walk into our office of our employer, as we are when we are at home. We manifest different aspects. You know, the feelings that I have inside of myself when I'm preparing a meal for my family are not the same as when I'm testifying in a court case for somebody to be able to keep their child. So, and we have to allow, I think, for that in order to be able to evolve psychospiritually. So, mythology patterns itself over and over through the ages. There are many, many stories about the dying rising sun gods and the birthing mother whose child dies or whose child grows up and makes choices that maybe they wouldn't make for them. And, you know, these are all stories that we can identify with ourselves and take comfort from knowing that there are, you know, thousands and thousands of years worth of people who have gone through this and that we can learn from.
Well, and let's talk about then archetypally, like this aspect of the divine feminine that's associated with death. And I know in my priestess program that I did, which is through, it's the 13 Moon Mystery School, which is through the Sanctuary of the Open Heart. There was an archetype called, well, I mean, you find like the destroyer aspect. There was a creator, preserver, destroyer. So there's death and destruction in that. And then there was also an archetype that we specifically worked with that we called the Queen of Death. And I'm curious for you, you know, how do you see this aspect of death being intertwined with the feminine?
Well, I think that first of all, the similarities between birth and death are undeniable. And I'm going to try to straddle your question here because I feel like there's a two-pronged answer to it.
Okay.
And one of them is psycho-spiritual, but the other one is human physical. And so if we talk about death and we set it alongside of birth, what we discover is that they are the two most important rites of passage that we have. So we're born, we come into the world, whatever it is that animates us becomes a learning thing. And we go through our lives until we reach the point of death. And the idea that life is not the opposite of death, birth is the opposite of death, is one sort of correction of the oversteer that I have found helpful to make. The other piece of that is that when we look at the physicality of it, the breathing patterns are very similar to labor in death. So we find difference in the breathing patterns. We find difference in, there's a transition that happens there, that happens in birth. It also happens in death, where you kind of reach the point of no return. We're very distracted in both of these rites of passage. There's nothing else that we can really focus on other than what our body is doing, and our body knows how to die. So the idea that that we can all be mothers, that we can all be the mothers of our own soul, spirit. I'm not sure that I have the best word for whatever it is that animates us, but we birth it. We bring it into our body at the beginning, and we birth it into whatever adventure is next at the end. And those two processes are very similar. And it always amuses me that, you know, we celebrate birthdays and coming of age and marriages and retirements, and then we act like we're not going to die. We're in such a death denying culture. And so to move that over into the psycho-spirituality of it is to acknowledge that there are helpers. There are helpers on each side of the threshold. So if we imagine a threshold through which humans are coming and going, or anything is coming and going, and we imagine whoever is delivering that child, not just the mother whose body is birthing it, but the one that is there to help. And then we image the other end of that. We have to imagine that there's someone helping on both sides of that threshold there too. And so the curiosity question is, who's handing that baby in, and who are we handing that person off to at the end? And so part of what I do is I'm a death midwife, and I am in the death threshold. I've been in the birth threshold many, many times, but that was as a younger woman. And now I'm in the death threshold and have seen some pretty amazing things from people who are committing their final rite of passage. And it is sacred space.
Yeah.
It is sacred space, because the idea that when that final exhale happens, above all else, what happens is we cease to be human. And I don't really need to concern myself with what you believe happens after that. That's not my function. My function is to make sure that this actual final rite of passage is sacred.
Okay. I have a couple of questions for you, and I want to, sometimes more than one shows up, I'm like, oh, I don't want to lose it. Okay. One of them is, do you have an opinion or thoughts on who or what is there at those transitions, the helpers?
Okay. So first of all, within my personal spiritual practice, I think there are many things that exist outside of time, space, and the five senses. I also think that while they can be kind and loving and generous, they don't have to be. They're not bound by the rules of society or human society or humanity. So they don't have to be honest. And they can show up in whatever form they want that they believe will make the most sense to you. So having said that, I've seen everything show up in that death threshold. I've seen the Abrahamic prophets. I've seen gods and goddesses. I've seen pets and relatives, angels. And when I say I've seen it, you know, it's not like I've viscerally laid my eyes on it, but I've heard the people talking about it. And that is their reality and their death. So I'm going to believe what I'm being told.
I was thinking for myself when my second child was born. I didn't so much with my first child. I, you know, went the whole epidural route and was not really present to that. She was just bewildered by the whole experience, frankly. But the second time, it was a very conscious, intentional choice not to medicate and to experience the whole thing, which was excruciatingly painful. But one of the things that was clear, well, there's several things. And as you were talking about kind of birth, death, obviously I don't have a memory of dying before in a, you know, from a human form, but that being at the threshold of something and having to be absolutely surrendered to it and not just like having to just, you just have to, that is the only way you're going to get through it is by giving up basically and giving over. I can see how that would be very much like threshold of what death might be like as well. Like you just cannot hold on anymore. This is not this out of your control. And the other thing that happened was a very deep felt sense of lineage. And I'm not even sure it's my own, but connection to women who had births going way, way, way back. And that I was a part of this, like there was a line and I was in it. Like I was just, I was part of it and they were behind me and around me and it was all of us.
Yes, I agree with the whole lineage idea. And I know that when I was pregnant for the first time, I was nervous about what was going to happen with the labor and delivery. And even though I knew lots of women who were willing to help me, I would have to really psych myself up. So I'd be in the grocery store and I'd say, okay, every single person in this grocery store came into the world this way. And you're going to be okay. But when you're right there in the middle of it, you can never really anticipate the power of it.
Yeah.
And some women have some very traumatic birth experiences and some have it pretty easy. So just like death, some people labor through their death and some have a very easy time of it.
Yeah. I guess my other question for you is, you said you're not really concerned with what's happening after death, right? You're here for, you know, that part of the transition, the initiation, I don't, the rite of passage. I don't know what word you use, so now I'm losing it. But do you, as an animist or as a pagan, though, do you have an opinion on kind of where that energy goes? I'm going to guess it's not heaven.
I can take a stab at this, Liz, but it's part of it is because I've had a near-death experience. Mm. And part of it is because I've seen enough death to be able to just sort of formulate some thought processes around this. But it sounds kind of cliche. I've heard this said a lot, and it's often said very hollowly, but we're made of energy, and energy doesn't die. It continues on. And I don't know what that's going to look like for anyone else. I know what it felt like for me, and I've also, I'll share with you a story about someone that I sat with. I want to make sure that I get this right. But She kind of summed it up for me when I was sitting with her, and I had been sitting with her for a while. And one time I came in and she said, I'm glad you're here. They said I couldn't go until you got here. And I said, who are they? And she said, all of them. And I said, okay, well, do you need to go now? And she said, no, not right now. All right. So I sat with her, and then I came back another time, and she was not coherent. She was not communicative. She was, I call it the death song. She was singing her death song, which is sort of that rhythmic moaning that can sometimes happen. And then she sort of turned her head to me and said, here I go. I hate this part. And she was gone. And, you know, I immediately was like, wait, you know, I have questions.
Yeah.
But I've seen enough of things like that, that I have a pretty strong opinion that it's not just the end.
Yeah.
That there is a continuation of it. And I have all sorts of ideas and analogies of what that looks like. In that I feel like perhaps this human form is just a small finger puppet of who we truly are and how big we really are and how finite our brains are and unable to wrap around the concept of something that, I mean, we're only just now discovering other galaxies, right? And we can't wrap our minds around that. And I think that the energy that embodies us for this having of the human experience is much bigger than the human brain can encompass. And the other piece of that is that so many religions have beaten it into the human population that you have to transcend the human experience. And I am of the opposite opinion, is that we're here to have that experience and all of the array of emotions and happenings that go with that. And being able to transcend it momentarily can be a nice break. But for the most part, I think if we're here to have the human experience, then we need to have the human experience.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. Yeah, I'm wanting to share this too. You know, my own experience, which I don't have much, but being present to death. But several years ago, my family and I were hiking in Canada, and a man collapsed on the trail ahead of us and died. And there was a sort of a long process. He was young. He was in his 40s. He had his wife and daughter. His daughter was 5. And my kids were, I think, around like 4 and 7 at the time. And there were, you know, blessedly a lot of people that were trying to help on the trail that day. There were doctors. There were people who were giving this man CPR. I don't really know what happened. I think he had a heart attack. And the daughter, we had the daughter with us, with our kids, to just try and keep her away from, so she didn't have to witness this happening with her dad. And he didn't make it. He died. And so, oh gosh, it was a whole very powerful experience and really tragically beautiful experience, because the trail was closed while this was happening. And so there were a lot of people that were witness to it, that were deeply touched by it, that were, you know, like really trying to support this woman, and we were trying to support the child, and you know, it was very powerful. But I felt something when he left, and it's very hard to put into words, but it was sort of like a like an energy reverberation, like something being absorbed into something bigger. And we were in this beautiful, beautiful canyon, you know, just an absolutely perfect day. And so like you look around and it's just stunning and your heart's full of love anyways, because this situation is just cracking your heart open, you know, to be part of it and witness it. And it felt like this big reverberation of like, whoosh, something joining it. And I don't know that that makes sense, but it makes perfect sense. Yeah, it had a profound impact on me, and it made me feel like wherever this man had gone, that I don't know if I want to say it was okay, but that there was something else going on, and that he was okay. Like
that he would be okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I would also add that that same sort of contraction of time and space happens at a birth, too.
Yeah.
And there is this continuum that gets sort of warped. Somebody comes in or somebody goes. And it can be a really beautiful thing. It can be very sacred. It is very sacred. And it's something that you touched on that I wanted to just comment on too, is that Western society has hidden death from children for far too long. The funeral industry has hidden death from us for far too long. And we've been taking care of our own dying and our dead for far longer than it's been in the hands of industry. And again, another patriarchal industry. And so being able to reclaim that and to normalize death for our children and our beloveds, I think it's really important work.
Yeah. And I want to say that I think this mother really handled it quite, I mean, gosh, as well as she could have, you know, like her daughter, you know, seeing her dad, like explaining to her right there, like, daddy's gone, he's not coming back, like, this is what's happened. And I'll never forget, this little girl came back over to my kids and her eyes were really, really wide. And she's like, my daddy's gone. I'm never going to see him again. And my partner and I were like, you know, really trying to hold it and keep it together. Like, yep. And then she says, it's too scary. Let's play. And
yeah,
off they
kids
went.
Kids are the best.
Yeah. And off they went up the trail, kind of playing like tag. And it was a beautiful exchange all the way around. My daughter was the oldest, and so I think she understood what had happened and really had an emotional response. And my son, who was four, was like, well, you know, he'd seen Coco, and he's like, well, put him on your ofrenda. Like, he's going to come and his spirit's going to come back and visit you. I bet he will. He'll come back and see you. It was
fantastic.
It was lovely. It was really mm-hmm. and painful and awful and all the things.
Of course.
Yeah.
And, you know, grief and loss are characters in our lives. Yeah. And we experience them in many different ways over the course of a lifetime. And death is part of life.
Yeah. Well, and I have a question for you. If you, as part of your own spiritual practice or the way in which you work with others, have a practice of working with the dead, working with the ancestors and people who have transitioned.
Yes, many, many different practices. One of the things that we do with our Earth Traditions group at Samhain, and we've not been really coming together much since the pandemic, but it'll likely take hold again. And I just actually finished a Samhain gathering last weekend, because it was the only time that we could get the venue. But so the idea is to keep an ancestor altar, which I do in my home. And I keep like looking over your shoulder because it's right over there. Mm-hmm. But storytelling, honoring, remembering. And one of the things that we do it's called the Dumb Supper. I'm sure you may have heard of it, which is a meal that is taken in silence. And each action is hypersensitized. So you go through this whole meal holding a fork in your hand and feeling what that fork feels like and spearing a piece of food with it and bringing it up and letting yourself inhale the aroma of it and feeling it pass over your lips and feeling your teeth pierce and the flavor run across your tongue. And, you know, every single step that we pay no attention to while we're wolfing down, you know, a fish sandwich from the drive-thru kind of thing. So, so this is an intentional meal that is taken in honor of someone in particular. Oftentimes we'll consult in advance to see what some people would like to have there as a favorite dish of their ancestor. And then we do what's called a dance with the dead after that. So it is an initiation. We put ourselves in a circle. We say, we go around that circle to say, I'm safe with you. We call the ancestors in by name. So each person calls that ancestor's name. We will, it's a promise that we make. We will call your name at Samhain. And then we dismiss the elements. We take them away. We release to the north the flesh and the bones, release to the east the breath and the voice, to the south the passion and fire, to the west the blood, sweat, and tears. And then we meet in the center as a grieving village. And then we have a couple of pieces of music that we use. The lights are completely turned out. Every possible light source in that room is extinguished. Windows are sealed. Doors are sealed. People are told not to wear luminous dials on their watches. And then there's a dance that happens. And it's essentially improv. So as the music's playing, you touch someone else's hand and you finish the stroke and you're moving through, and people will dance with one another. And what has been discovered in this practice that we do each year is that there are a lot more people in that room than who signed up for that event. And all of the senses are heightened. I had a woman tell me that her father died 2 weeks before her wedding, and he used to wear Old Spice, and she smelled him in the room and she found him and they danced and she got her dance with her dad. It's powerful. It's moving. It's visceral. And it gives us a stopping off place to move into the darkness. We also will, oftentimes I've started it out by having them eat pomegranate to commit to the darkness. So here are some pomegranate seeds. Here is Persephone's journey to the underworld, you know, where she is the queen of death. And she has a lover that she cares about. And they have one of the most healthy marriages in all of mythology, Persephone and Hades. And so she's very important in the death threshold, in that she is a loving queen and a harsh defender of the people in the land of the dead.
Yes. Well, I was going to say healthy marriage, except for the whole kidnapping part, but maybe you don't ascribe to that. I know there's many versions of the myth.
Yeah. And I do wonder about that, Liz, because, yeah, you know, there is nothing wrong with a young woman being sexually active or activated.
Absolutely. And
so there are parts of that story that say that she went willingly.
I've heard retellings of that and I love it. And that she felt particularly called to the dead. She wanted to be with the dead. She wanted to work with the dead. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I was going to ask you too, and now I'm like, maybe I know the answer to this, but I wondered if, like, I've definitely heard people say, like, you know, there's this concept of the veils being thin right now. And then I've heard other people be like, the veil is always thin. Like, we're just, you know, like things are passing through like all the time. And I wonder what your perspective is on that. Like, is this a particular moment in which our dead are louder and more present, or is it we're just paying attention?
I truly believe that the veil is thin at thinner at different times of the year. Now, it can certainly be thin in the dying room, you know, where things are coming through. However, here's where my paganism and animism sort of really kicks in. When we have a birthing woman or a dying woman, or we're in the birth or the death threshold, when that's happening, we are focused completely on that. So when you were giving birth, there was, you were distracted by the birth process from doing all of the things that you might normally do under other circumstances. You probably, maybe you didn't have makeup on, you know, you were definitely not concerned with modesty. You know, everything was focused on birthing, right? And the same thing with dying. Dignity might be, is probably gone. We're totally focused on laboring ourselves, on using our breath to labor ourselves out of our body. And we're distracted with that. So the things that we would normally do, the mask that we show the world, is gone. There's no pretense anymore. So at the birthing time of the year, which is May, Beltane, at the dying time of the year, which is October and November, specifically November, Samhain, the earth is also distracted and cannot hold up the veils that would maybe normally obscure us from seeing other. So we mirror this earth. We move in the same cycles. We don't feel the same way in gray, cold February that we do in golden, sunny June. And if it's that way, then we can also experience that in birth and in death. And so to answer your question, yes, I believe there are times when the veil is thinner than others, and veils are not always thin. Sometimes things are much more obscured than at other times. And if we want to bring that into the physical world, a burqa isn't a thin veil. Back in the Victorian times, we used to have the widow's weeds, where we would often see the grieving widow clutching the arm of someone to help her walk. And a lot of times it's because those veils were so thick, she couldn't see. So she had to be led. We look at Judaism, we look at the temple veils. Those veils were as thick as a man's hand. Sometimes they were 4 and 6 inches thick. It took a dozen men to open them on either side. So veils are not always thin.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have so many more things that I want to ask, and we're out of time. Dang it. this has been so, I'm trying to find the right word. I started to say delightful, and I'm not quite sure that is the, it is, but it's also, it's been really instructive and insightful. So I'm truly grateful for your time, Angie, and your insights. It's been a really meaningful conversation for me. So thank you.
Yeah, I love to share about this. It's my life's work. And I feel like, you know, I also am again involved in the interfaith forums, and have been for most of my adult life. But I think that each path is allowed to be different. And yet there is a fundamental underlayment of we breathe in, we live, we exhale, we die, that that we can agree on, and that that could be the basis of helping us come together as humanity. The idea that nobody gets out alive, that we're all going to die one day, and that we all come into the world through the sacred feminine, who embodies the divine feminine as she gives birth, and that those patterns are absolutely not obscured in our world and on our planet, and that it's, we've got to get out of these confinements.
I want to say something affirming to that, like, yes, may it be so, or let's do that. Or you listener, whatever you want to put on that as your affirming statement for that, and you can add that too. Well, thank you so much for your time. Thanks to all of you for listening. I will put more information about you, Angie, in the show notes. So if you want to find her online, you can do that. And yeah, as always, thank you for listening. Thanks for being here and being interested in this subject. It means a great deal to me to be able to share this with you. So if you like the show, you can subscribe, you can give it a 5-star review, you can tell your friends about it, you can do all those things. And until next time, take very good care of yourself, and I'll be with you again soon. Home to Her is hosted by me, Liz Kelly. You can visit me online at hometoher.com, where you can find show notes and other episodes. You can read articles about the sacred feminine. And you'll also find a link to join the Home to Her Facebook group for lots more discussion and exploration of her. You can also follow me on Instagram at Home to Her to keep up to date with the latest episodes. Thanks so much for joining us, and we'll see you back here soon.